Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning, everyone. That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown, and you are listening to the Brown Briefly. It is Tuesday, it's not May 18th anymore. It's June 15th. And this morning, we have five Brieflies gathered via the magic of Zoom to discuss local, state, and national news and nonsense. Welcome to Lynn Kerrigan, Truman O'Brien, Kevin Jones, and Bruce Hallman. Hi, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. I like that. News and nonsense. Good job.
Morning, Gail.
Well, Brian loved his alliterations, you know.
He did.
Right.
I got that. It was a Brian Brown inspired. I'm Gail Kellner, your host for this week's program. Truman O'Brien is at the helm in the Voice of Vachon studio. Now, Truman, my first question is, do you use helm in a pilot studio, in a sound studio, or is it strictly a nautical term?
You know, that is a good question, Gail. In an airplane, you wouldn't call it the helm. You'd call it the flight deck, maybe, or the cockpit.
Okay.
But, flight deck. Yeah, flight deck or cockpit. But in the studio, Well, you know, I think helm is probably an appropriate thing to say.
I don't mind flight deck either. So I'm going to say that.
Yeah. Also recognize that almost all of the terminology from flying comes from sailing.
It does.
You know, the starboard and port and decks and captains. And I mean, all that stuff. So, you know, when the military became the Air Force, began Army Air Force and then became the Air Force. I mean, they really adopted a lot of the terminology and structure of the Navy.
And I have to tell you one more thing. That you know, that English became the international language of aviation, much to the chagrin of the French. The French were most upset about that English was chosen. And so consequently, if you look at the ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Authority, the weather reports that are now the official weather reports that we all use, they all have abbreviations in them that, like, for example, MIST is BR. And everybody goes, BR? What's BR? It's Brume, because it's French for MIST. So the French had to get their digs in. So there you go.
It's a consolation for the French then.
That's correct. Awesome. That's correct. Yeah.
I do have to say that reminds me that somewhere I heard that, for example, the Navy has more airplanes than the Air Force and the Army has more boats than the Navy. And so the idea that it was the Army Air Force and it brought nautical terminology sort of makes even more sense when you think about that.
No, I paid a lot of money in therapy, $4,800, to learn that hardly ever things really make sense. So I'm giving that to you for nothing. Don't expect things to make sense all the time.
There you go.
It is interesting, though, you know, there are forensic linguists who actually can trace history and events. Bruce, weigh in on this or anyone else with this information, more information, but because language kind of trails right along with us and we take it wherever we go, it integrates as populations integrate, and it leaves its own little mark. And the dominant language is marked by the places that it enters. Bruce, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, it's just a fascinating article in this week's New Yorker about the Iliad and the Odyssey, and about whether or not they were created by one poet or whether they were a collection of oral stories that were accumulated and finally written down once there was a written language. And, you know, and it's true in what you're saying, Gail, is because as languages develop and as empires and nations expand and contract, I mean, the linguistic sort of remnants that are there are a real good record. And this article talked about how one of the things that struck me is they were talking about steel. And at times in the Odyssey, steel is more precious than gold. And other times it's used for arrowheads where you just sort of throw it away. You shoot it and never get it back. And so which indicates that the Odyssey and Iliad were written over a long period of time with the emergence of the Iron Age. So at the very beginning, iron was very, very valuable. Toward the end, iron's just a throwaway. So it's that kind of thing that just sort of works itself into language that I think is fascinating. Truman.
Go ahead, Truman. Yeah.
There is a big exception to that, though, and that is Iceland. Mm-hmm. As you're probably aware, the Icelandic language has not changed, and they do not allow foreign words to enter into the language. If there's some new product or new thing, they develop a word for that that meets the Icelandic tradition. And so that's a language that hasn't changed in thousands of years, and it's that way on purpose. Which I think is pretty cool. You can go back and, you know, see what was or still is.
And the French. So if you step out of line, it's off with your tongue, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah, right. The French try that as well, but not as successfully as the Islanders.
I was once up in Northern Ireland and went into a little restaurant, and there was a fellow came in the door, and he was as old as dirt and walking with a cane. And he comes in and he's talking to the hostess, and she can't understand him. And of course he's speaking Gaelic, and she says, "I'm so sorry. I just don't understand what you're saying." And he says, "Ah, so you're going to make me wrap my tongue around that ugly English."
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Just still furious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like flight deck, so I'm going to go for my hosting today and say Captain of the Airways Truman O'Brien will be taking us from his flight deck in the Voice of Vashon Studios on a 45-minute flight over the cultural and political landscape of our times.
There you go.
Excellent. So,
good morning, Truman. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Okay. Hey, and you see who's in the studio with me this morning?
I do.
Pretty cool, huh?
That's right, man. Nice. I'm wanting a little social contact and to burst out of my house at every opportunity. Those of us who live alone are not content to Zoom our lives away.
I beg you, come join
us at some point. But, you know, I'm also doing double duty here and trying to retrain myself with Truman. You never know when something unexpected will happen, and I may have to cover if Truman and Susan McCabe are gone. And
that's
so,
right. That's right.
I'm going over the switches and all of the flight deck module information so that I can engineer
captain.
Better.
So you could be captain of the airwaves.
There she is. Yeah.
Yeah.
You never know when Truman's going to try another landing in the treetops.
Exactly. How can he top that?
So to speak. I can tell you when the next time will be, and that is never.
Never.
Well, figure this, Truman. It must have shocked your heart so much you'll live for another 20 years.
Probably. Yeah, poor Mary. She's going to have to put up with me for a lot longer.
Well, and Truman, now it also seems like around about that time poetry entered your soul just as you were landing in the treetops.
It did.
So do you have any new poems to share with
us?
Oh
gosh, I don't, you know, but I was thinking of it the other day. Let me say this, Truman,
at the end of the show we're going to be talking about our new poet laureate, and Lynn is going to be sharing one of her poems, and we can hear your poem then, and gives you approximately 45 minutes to pull that up.
Oh, easy. Okay. I'll do it.
And no, right. I emailed you right before to say I did find Sandra Noel's poetry, and I am thinking that since we have that new poet laureate here, we'll feature her poems today, not mine.
Oh, cool.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Tell us more about her, Lynn, when we get to that segment toward the end of the show. I'd love to hear that. Okay, well, I thought that this was the week of the 100th anniversary of the launching of the Virginia 5. I have been corrected by our Guardian of the Galaxy that, in fact, it was in 2022, in March of 2022, that it was launched. So I'll back up a little bit. For those of our listeners who don't happen to know about the Virginia 5, it is a beloved boat in the Seattle, Puget Sound, now Salish Sea era, or those of us who've lived here for a long time, because it was one of the first boats, if not the first, tell us more, Bruce, in a moment, to provide access to Westerners to the islands. So prior to that, I don't believe there was any access to the islands except by private boat. And of course, the Virginia 5 was a private boat as well, but it ran a regular schedule. Like they said, there was one boat in the morning and one boat in the afternoon. And that was the entire schedule. And it zipped around Vashon Island. I think it circumnavigated it. Brian, Bruce could tell us more. What was interesting and fun for me is that my family has a close connection with it, because the pier, or what's left of the pier out in front of Sylvan Beach, is the remnants of the dock of one of the docks of the Virginia 5. And there are stories in my family. My grandfather commuting to work in Seattle, he'd go in the morning and on the morning boat and return in the afternoon. Story is he even carried the bricks that one, two at a time, one in each hand, down the long pier and along the boardwalk up to the house to build the foundation to our house here. And so wonderful stories and memories that my mother shared with me of chickens and goats on board. I don't know if they charge full fare for those, but it was a place where the ice came in for the ice boxes via the Virginia 5, all the supplies to the island that I'm aware of. At least it was the Amazon of the day delivery service to the islands. So it was christened, but not with the usual champagne and alcohol. So I'm going to turn it over to Bruce to tell us a little bit more about the Virginia 5.
Oh, sure. Virginia 5 is a great story. It was actually built by Captain Christensen, who lived just south of Liza Bula. He married the daughter of the people who owned the store, the Boon Guards, who owned the store at Liza Bula. But he actually worked in Seattle, and he got so frustrated with ferry service. And in fact, ferry service begins on Vashon in the late 1880s, and there's lots of mosquito fleet boats in the late 1890s through the 1930s. When the last mosquito fleet boats were running in the early 1940s and are largely replaced by car ferries. But when the Virginia 5 is launched, it was the fifth boat owned by the West Pass Transportation Company, which was run by Christensen. It was built specifically for the West Passage run. So it would start its route in Tacoma in the morning, go to Seattle, return to Tacoma in the afternoon. And it was built actually across the water on the Kitsap Peninsula at a place called Maplewood. Took the engine out of the old Virginia 4 and put it in the Virginia 5. It ran that route until 1938. It started in 1922. And ran until 1938, but what's fascinating to me is when the Virginia 5 is launched in 1922, that's sort of the height of ferry service on Vashon Island. I mean, there were 32 ferry docks on Vashon Island in 1922. Wow.
32?
Yeah. Yep, three car ferry docks, one at the north end, one at Portage, and one at the south end, and 29 Mosquito Fleet dock. So they were all over the island.
Wow.
And Gail's right. I mean, people would go to work, people would bring bricks, ice, chickens, clams, you know, whatever. I mean, they were the way to get around. I often tell the story. I mean, it was easier to get from Sylvan Beach to Ellisport by getting on a boat and going to Tacoma and then getting on an east side boat and coming up to Ellisport than it was to go across the island, because there were no roads. And the roads were virtually impassable. Or you needed to go by horse and buggy, which would take longer than the Mosquito Fleet boats. So it's kind of a fascinating time on Vashon. And it's a time when Vashon really faced the water. All of these communities, all of those ferry docks had stores, post offices, communities. They were all, the docks were really the center of the community, and they all faced the water.
Interesting. And native people in these had always used the waters as transportation, not much in the way of trails because of the thick forested land.
Mm-hmm. Right. Although native people did burn the island, they kept open what the first surveyors on the island in 1856 called swales. So you can go back to that original 1856 survey and you can see quite a bit of what the island looked like pre-European settlement on the island. And native people kept trails open to these swales because it was their major source of carbohydrates.
Right.
The native diet in Puget Sound was heavily carbohydrate short and heavily loaded with protein. And so camas root, you know, bracken root, acorns, I mean, all the kinds of things that could provide carbohydrates were in high demand. Easy to get protein.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What a time. Well, thank you for that. And can you tell us just briefly, Bruce, about it not being christened with a champagne bottle, the Virginia 5, which is, by the way, getting, I guess it's being kind of getting a refurbishing, a little update and a facelift, if you will. Oh, I don't love that term, but yes, it's getting a little love.
It is right now.
Old wooden boats need every now and then.
They do, yeah. In fact, the museum does an annual tour around Vashon Island on the Virginia 5, and it's scheduled for August 22nd this year, but it's been canceled. We just found out yesterday it's been canceled because the Virginia 5 is in dry dock and will not be out until late September or early October at the earliest. But yeah, she's undergoing sort of the major kind of repairs that a 100-year-old vessel needs. She went through a major refit in the 1990s. They rebuilt the engine, totally rebuilt the engine in the late 1990s, then pulled her out again in about 2006, 2007. And now she's out for, again, a major sort of work on her bottom, replacing timbers, that kind of stuff.
Go ahead, Kevin.
It is definitely worth, if you have the opportunity to take a tour of the Virginia 5, even if you don't leave the dock. The time that I was on the boat, they had diagrams of the power plant and the technology of the time, which was very advanced in terms of the propulsion system. And I found it pretty fascinating just to hear that history and to walk on those decks and get the feel of what life was like at that time when that was the source of transportation.
And Kevin, did you see it at the wooden boat facility there on Lake Union?
You know, that sounds very familiar. It's been some decades ago now that I was on the boat.
I believe that is where the Virginia 5 currently is moored, if that's the right word.
It was an open house type, come visit the Virginia 5. It could have been in conjunction with a boat show or some other event, but yeah.
Yeah, you'll find, for our listeners, generally speaking, when it's not in dry dock, you'll find it moored next to the new museum, MoMA, isn't it? Yeah.
Museum of History and Industry.
Right. It's right there. There it is. Right there in Lake Union. So, all right. Well, thank you everyone for that. And no alcohol was spilled on her decks or spilled across her bow on that day because we were already entering Prohibition in some form. Is that?
January 17th, 1920. Was the beginning of the Prohibition. So they christened her with a bottle of spring water from Christensen Creek, which ran right by the house where the Christensen lived. Again, Christensen Creek begins up at Christensen Pond, right off of Wax Orchards Road, which is now a land trust, an Audubon sort of bird site.
Beautiful. Kevin.
So is Christensen Creek and Fisher Creek, are they eventually one and the same, or they must have headwaters very next door to each other?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'd have to look at a map, you know, that could be. And you know, creek names have changed over the years. And so I'm not certain where Fisher Creek is.
It's just, I was happy to learn that I live near the headwaters of Fisher Creek. It actually runs just on our north property line. And it emerges from a culvert on Wax Orchard Road, just about 50 yards south of Christensen Pond. So I know Christensen Pond has got a different exit, right? There's another culvert there that goes under Wax Orchard Road. But I'm assuming that they joined forces fairly soon. But, you know, I've never looked at a map with enough detail to know.
Actually, they're two different watersheds. Christensen Pond runs north and goes under Redding's Beach Road, the north part of Redding's Beach Road, and then down and comes out right at Liza Beulah, just out there.
Fisher Creek.
Now you've talked me through it. Fisher Creek, it runs down the south end. So when you come up from Redding's Beach Road, that south road, which I can't remember the number on that, that's another valley and that's another watershed. So two separate watersheds, but
their headwaters are just on each on either side of a single ridge.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool.
I just wanted to say, you know, it seems quite appropriate looking back that 100 years ago, for different reasons, it was christened with water instead of alcohol. And in this day and age where water has become as valuable, if not more so, it's a beautiful thing the way that circled back around. And now we're protecting these waters and creeks, and really appreciate that. Truman, one last thought before we move
on. I just read something about the Virginia 5 that I thought was fascinating. It's a diesel fired boiler, but originally it burned the bunker C fuel, which is really thick, you know, heavy oil. Mm-hmm. And in order to get the thing up to temp, they used cordwood to get the get the boiler up to temp, and then once it got hot, then they could start using the bunker fuel. I thought that was kind of interesting.
What is bunker fuel?
That's another, really heavy. If I can interject, another almost like tarp thing. You wonder about where all the trees in Puget Sound went.
Yeah.
A typical mosquito fleet boat that burned wood burned 2 cords a mile.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
So the trip from Tacoma to Seattle is 40 miles.
Wow.
80 cords of wood each way. Twice a day.
Wow.
Same up and down the Columbia, right? I've seen the trail markers up at Stevenson about the ports off the Columbia that used the same huge amounts of cordwood to traverse that area as well.
Wow.
Yeah. So you see photographs of the old steamer docks. They were always lined with piles and piles of cordwood. Because every time a boat would pull in, they would load as much wood as they can get. I mean, 2 cords a mile.
That's a lot.
Going, you know, 20 miles an hour. That's a lot of wood.
Wow.
Well, hey, Kevin.
You know, I'm just astounded by the economics of that. I mean, as Truman knows, I've got some trees that have been removed from my property. They're either, you know, dead or dying or leaning into another tree or what have you. And so I've probably taken down maybe 3 cords worth of wood total. And I can tell you how much energy and time it takes to do that. So the idea that the economics of feeding that much wood and all those woodcutters and all the transportation of all that wood to the dock and drying and what have you was somehow offset by the fares that you could charge to take that boat just seems phenomenal to me.
Well, what else was there to do but chop wood at some point?
And iron your sheets.
The idea is you had to pay them all, right? You had to pay them all to do that. And so they had subsidies from the state, or the passenger fares were somehow significant enough to sustain that army of woodcutters and generate a profit for the company and keep the boat maintained and floating. So it just seems mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I understand it was 50 cents to ride the boat, but of course, 50 cents in that day is a different 50 cents than what we get in this day.
Yeah, when the Virginia 5 first started, it was 10 cents.
Wow. There.
fair. So, okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And I mean, wood was basically quote unquote free. You know, you had lots of young men working in a wage economy. You know, so yeah, right. I mean, it was very different economics than today. Yeah. I mean, a cord of wood today is $200, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that if the wood, standing wood, was viewed as an obstruction to agriculture, mm-hmm. and you were just looking for a way to get rid of it,
that's right.
Then yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
Very different view of that resource now.
So according to something I just looked up, 10 cents in 1922 is the equivalent purchasing power of about $160 today.
Wow.
There you go.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers has a plan to build a 20-foot wall, or proposing to build a 20-foot wall around Miami, creating one day perhaps a new island of Miami. Who's inside the wall? Who's outside the wall? Maybe other low-lying areas will be walled in and take lessons from the past and go back to traveling via boat. Any thoughts on that proposal? Have anyone been following that story?
No, but I imagine that it is actually going to go just around Mar-a-Lago.
Go ahead, Kevin.
You know, I'm again fascinated by the dichotomy that climate change produces, because there's several impacts, right, that we all feel from climate change. We know about wildfires now in a very significant and a different way than we had a relationship with wildfires just 4 years ago. And then there's the health implications of wildfires. And there's the communities, of course, who are burdened by, energy generation, which produces carbon, which produces climate change, which produces sea level rise. But here we have the wealthy, sometimes the wealthiest of the wealthy, on waterfront property, who are now in jeopardy. And as a government, you know, it's now a decision has to be made, is where do we put government resources? Is it to protect the wealthiest of the wealthy who live on those fine waterfront homes because they're going to suffer? Or is it that we're going to devote that income to the communities who've been suffering all along in the creation of this problem? And how do we adjudicate between addressing the climate pollution and mitigating the climate pollution versus spending money and time on the consequences of that climate pollution, like sea level rise? So lots of dichotomies on how decision-making on how to sort that out, I think will be quite challenging for us and governments across the country, across the world, I'm sorry, as things progress right. From here.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else have a thought on that? Sometimes I wonder what we'll end up doing with regard to the Salish Sea here, and can we hold back the tides? I was up in Port Townsend over the weekend, and I looked across the way at a point on Whidbey Island and realized that's the spot that you would want to, if you wanted to do some kind of mitigation to stop some of the tidal surges or something that we may be facing, that's probably where the Army Corps of Engineers would begin to look at trying to do something like a major build there, in addition to Deception Pass on the other side of Whidbey, up a little further north. But it's an interesting thing that we're facing, and the Army Corps of Engineers has an interesting thing. They're supposed to protect people and property, but the way that's been defined, Kevin, which you might find especially interest to us all and our listeners too, is that because the rich own property that's the most valuable, that's the property that would get protected, as opposed to the outlying areas that are, you know, not as valuable. They may not get the protection. So it's that, again, that question of equity and how that sorts itself out. Lynn, I can see you have a thought there in
the
background.
Well, that was exactly what I was going to contribute. I'm sort of deeply cynical about how our politics rule our policies, and think the same thing that you do, that people or places like Houston, you know, where there's a big oil refinery business and, you know, a lot of wealthy politicians living there in that floodplain also around Galveston and Houston. I know that they're working hard to get that area re-engineered. New Orleans, not so much, you know, all of that difficulty getting New Orleans sorted out after that big flood of, you know, Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita has sort of gone pretty slowly. And Bruce, you may know about this. I'm quite curious how the Netherlands managed to reclaim and protect their low country, you know, with all that system of dikes. How did they manage to do that, you know, in the face of such politics?
And the thumbs of small children, right?
Yeah.
Hans, yes.
I mean, yeah, you got to remember, I mean, the Netherlands, the area that the Netherlands has reclaimed is relatively small. When you look at the peninsula of Florida, I mean, the highest point in the state of Florida is like 300 feet above sea level. Well, the last major sea level change, global sea level change, was over 300 feet. Wow. You know, if you look at any of the maps of what happens when most of the ice caps melt, I mean, all of Florida, most of southern Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana are all underwater. I mean, this is sort of, you know, whistling in the dark. I mean, it's coming, and yeah, it's going to come fast. And when the tipping point hits, it's going to come very, very rapidly. And you can build walls around Miami, but Miami is done for.
Yeah, I have a feeling you're right about that. I'm going to move us forward to a little good news section here. Bree whales, under the scenario we were just talking about, are going to have more water, apparently. But in the meantime, it's very interesting to know that gray whales were released recently through a court action, were given protection along the coasts of Washington, Oregon, and California. So I was really happy to see that that had happened. There was a lawsuit, I believe, please anyone fill in the blanks, against the Environmental Protection Agency because they had not properly protected an endangered species. And so hence, that was some great news. The Native American woman, Miss Deborah Haaland, did I pronounce it right? Department of Interior.
Haaland, I think. H-A-A-L-A-N-D.
Department of Interior. She's looks like they're going to be moving to reinstate the boundaries and protections of public lands that were repealed during the or pulled back during the Trump era, including in the Grand Staircase Escalante, Bears Ears area. Those are both in the Southwest, and then a marine park off of New England. So good news around on that account. Anyone else have some good news to share with us that they picked up this week?
They picked up what?
Good news to share. Oh. Lynn?
With trepidation, I want to mention something that was in the newspaper at the Seattle Times on Sunday, June 6th, in the Northwest section, Section C1. I just have to say that I think it's wonderful that people are getting creative about how to save salmon and really work at building their habitat better and sort of, there was this great article on you know, making sure there's enough shade and structures for the salmon to hide in and, you know, make it easier to make their journeys. But I just want to say, and forgive me, this is fairly rude, but I can't resist. It's the greatest headline of all time, I think, where it says, harnessing the energy of beavers to save the planet. That just cracked me up. And so I just need to distribute that. I wish that title was there in high school when I could have used it. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Anyone else have anything? Kevin?
Yeah. Israel looks like they now have a government.
Yeah. Tell us more, Kevin, because we may not get to that section at the end of the show that I had outlined. So talk about that for a minute.
Well, you know, about a year ago or so on this show, we were talking about democracies and the different, not only our government, but other governments and their embrace or lack of embracing of democracies. And at the time, demonstrations in Hong Kong were starting up And I remember at the time Bruce said that, you know, eventually China is going to win that fight. And it looks like China is now winning that fight. But we also talked about Israel. And there's a couple of interesting corollaries. One is Netanyahu's been in power for a long time, facing charges, significant charges, potentially, if he loses his seat as prime minister. And the three votes to elect a government, which is a parliamentary system in Israel, I believe, the Knesset, they have to have enough parties come together to form a majority, to form a government. And that hadn't happened in three iterations. They sort of made concessions that the top two would sort it out. And that's how Netanyahu is still in power as prime minister up until last week, where a new government was formed. The first time that an Arab represented party is part of the government. And Netanyahu's comment is that, well, that government won't last long. They don't have enough cohesion to really stay together. Apparently the biggest cohesion they have is to send Netanyahu into retirement and possibly into major court battles to determine whether he stays a free man or not in Israel. So again, it'll be fascinating to watch, but Israelis have now finally gotten to the point after more than a year of where they now, it looks like, have a government formed by a majority of the groups, of the parties.
Sounds a little bit like the Democratic Party here.
Certainly some parallels, I would say.
Lynn.
Kind of related to that, I'm also thrilled to read that the European Union is cracking down on corporations who are not paying taxes at all in the European Union, and I expect that to swing around towards the United States at some point. You know, we're in a serious economy need for some extra money, and it seems like revenues from those who have the most money might be willing to contribute, and they're being forced to contribute now, which I like.
Right. Yeah, there's been a little game of cat and mouse with corporations hiding all around the world in P.O. boxes in tiny
exactly.
countries that don't hold them accountable to paying taxes. And now it looks like one of the ways that this is being dealt with by the EU, and it's expected that Biden is going to follow suit, is that it's where they do their business. So they're going to be paying taxes where they have their, wherever they're doing business, wherever they have customers, they're going to have to be paying taxes. And I'm really happy to see that's about time on that one. Okay, I didn't really finish recognizing Kevin Jones, our Vashon's own superhero of activism, and at the helm of Vashon, of Indivisible Vashon. Kevin, would you like to add any thoughts about the, we've got a few more minutes before we go to our poetry section. Talk a little bit about the G7 meeting going on this week. What do you see coming out of that to better humanity? And in general to the group, is it right to exclude other countries? And why not meet under the umbrella of the UN?
That's an interesting question. Well, first of all, the G7 is seven of the world's richest, wealthiest countries who subscribe generally to democratic principles. And I did have, prompted by this question, I did take a look at what's on their agenda. And it turns out that agreeing to make multinational companies pay more tax is one of the items that was on the agenda, as you mentioned. And they're also working towards a stronger global health system that can protect us all from future pandemics. So I think there's some good news there if the countries can find ways to cooperate. But it also, the agenda includes climate change. And of course, it's an economic summit, so it does include trade. But my understanding is that, and I don't know if it's been released yet, but there will be a statement released, typically, if the countries can agree, and I think they will this year, given that we have a new president. And they'll be able to release a statement of their goals and objectives based on the conversations they've had. So the UN, of course, has its own forum, its own collection of multiple countries. And so I guess I would say that the G7 probably serves a very specific purpose that is under the umbrella of all of those countries in the UN who have that other platform to gather. But hadn't thought about the pros and cons of a G7 versus a non-G7.
Yeah, it just always kind of strikes me as like, the good old boys club at some level, like, sorry about that, guys. But just like this idea that, yeah, if you've got the money to belong to the, to the club and get in, then you get a voice in this. And if you don't, mm-hmm. well, then that's another, then you're somewhat excluded. And so I wonder why, I'm curious, of course, the UN has other formats and rules and regulations in how things are done. So maybe it's a reason to get together without all of that. I don't know.
Well, there probably is a history here. And since trade is part of it, and these are the countries that have the bulk of global trade, my guess is that they have certain set of conversations that they have that, say, the country of Ghana or Cameroon may not have that volume of trade to really feel it's valuable for them to sit at the table. Bruce probably has a perspective there.
Yeah, recognize who's not in the G7. I mean, China, one of the largest economies in the world, Russia, a very significant economy in the world. And so, the G7 has that sort of liberal democratic, not in a left wing, but the old liberal concept, democratic sort of emphasis behind it, and has always been that. It has a purpose, and it's sort of similar to the purpose of the Security Council in the UN or the US Senate. I mean, it is kind of a good old boys club in that sense, but it has a purpose behind it and a reason behind it. And whether it's outlived that reason, like the Senate may have outlived its rationale.
There you go.
I mean, those are questions that are legitimate questions to ask.
Okay, I'm going to move us along because I want to give time both to Truman. You get the last word today after Lynn gives us Lynn Kerrigan, our former Georgia Peach poet, provocateur, musician, feminist, and fighter for justice. Poet herself, can you talk about our new Vashon Poet Laureate and maybe share one of her poems?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Gail. I'm introducing, as did the Beachcomber in the last couple of weeks, the elevation of Sandra Noel to the Poet Laureate of Vashon. We have this tradition, and she will serve from 2021 through 2023. Being turned over by poet Susan Lynch, who really got shortchanged because of the pandemic and a lot of the venues sort of shut down. So even though we've moved on, I was pretty impressed. I don't know Sandra Noel, and I hadn't heard her poems, but she's quite well published. She has 4 chapbooks, The Gypsy in My Kitchen, Into the Green, The River, Love Island, about her growing up here on Vashon, not growing up, but her time here on Vashon. She moved here in 1981, I think, and works as a freelance illustrator. But as I read some of her promotions and reviews of her chapbooks, I was really intrigued about her use of not only language, being very dynamic and powerful language, but her connection to the forests and the natural world, and her quote, wild and dangerous and wondrous information about her language. Stone and bone, I'm going to read very quickly. I want to become a stone in this meandering river, large enough to hold my place through spring floods, small enough for a returning salmon to consider, nose me gently before struggling a little further upstream, where she will dig into lighter gravel, a nest for her bright orange eggs, attracting the blood-colored males already on their way to death, until both together, open mouth, mix eggs and seed. And after she covers each nest, no longer able to resist the relentless downstream current as it carries her spent body gently back over the hard-won, riffled river bottom to be the last place she rests, stone and bone together, bleached white and worn with weather, water, and time, inanimate, unnoticed, dreaming. One molten, born in a river of fire, cooled to stillness by a river of ice, the other a silver sea traveler, until natal desire compels her into sinuous red light.
Wow.
Woohoo.
Fabulous. All right, folks, we're out of time. You ready for the quick haiku?
Okay, let's give it to us. Thank you, Lynn, for that. And congratulations to our new poet laureate. And Truman, let's hear what you got.
Sun streaming brightly.